Hey there, listener. This week's episode of the Bebop Beat contains information about firearms and the effects that ammunition can have on the human body. Please listen with care.
Hello, I'm Lauren Thates, and I'm a terrific guy, exactly the person you thought I was.
And I'm Jamie Sanchez. I wish to be fluid like water.
Are you ready for the beat?
I'm ready for the beat.
Welcome back to another week of the Bebop Beat. I am Lauren. I'm here with my friend Jamie. And in just a second, we're going to introduce a very special guest. But before we do that, I just wanted to celebrate the fact that here in Chicago, the weather is finally nice. I got to get outside this weekend. And I've been really reflecting on the fact that we have spent like a year indoors. Jamie, what have you been doing as an extrovert for a year indoors?
Well, for the last 3 months, we've been doing this podcast.
Touche. I know just like this weekend, you had an Anime Chicago thing though, right?
Yeah. So for listeners who are tuning in, Anime Chicago is a nonprofit I help run with my team of five others. And we have been extremely social during quarantine. In particular, we've been hosting monthly meetups via Discord, in which roughly 20 to 30 people join us. And I'm meeting new faces all the time, honestly. It's really surprising. And I didn't realize how uncommon it's been until I talked to my good friend Trin, who's the co-host of Friendshipping Podcast. So I've been made aware that this is highly unusual. And it made me really grateful for all of the ongoing projects that I have.
I love Friendshipping. What did you talk about with Trin?
So the show has been getting into like what is before times and as an introvert, how did you adjust to isolation and then what is going to happen with the after times, right? And so there's this anxiety building for many introverts that's like, oh, we have to be back out in public and just trying to figure out how to acclimate to whatever the next thing looks like. So yeah, it was a really great discussion, and we should be able to hear that in the next couple weeks.
Very cool. I consider myself an extrovert, and I was just saying on Twitter a couple of days ago how I have really locked down my weekly routine. I have 2 workout classes a week, 2 bass lessons a week, at least 2 podcast sessions with you a week. I don't know if I have room to ever go back out in society ever again.
Just stay indoors forever now. I also mentioned the fact that even though we're watching Bebop and everything is space travel, like I really wish we had teleporters. Teleporters would save so much time from all of our social events going to and from. Just teleport me to the thing and then teleport me straight into my bed in pajamas and we'll be good.
It would also make me feel a lot safer because one of the things that I'm the most squicky about right now is getting on a plane. Like if there is a Dragon Con this year, would I feel comfortable going on a plane to Atlanta? I'm just not sure.
Man, it's wild that you bring that up. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about traveling on spacecraft in a little bit through our episode.
Yeah, let's introduce our listeners to our new friend. Today in the studio, well, the remote studio with us, is Eddie Doty. Eddie has a very interesting career as an executive producer of interactive content. You may know his work from Twitch. You may know his work from Geek and Sundry. But I was introduced to him as somebody who knows Jeet Kune Do as well as firearms. Just an extremely interesting person. Hello, Eddie.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's very nice meeting you all. And yeah, so I'm having fun doing all this research into Cowboy Bebop, which is kind of like a dead angle in my anime consumption.
Oh, wow. That's pretty wild because that's usually people's top 10, if not the only anime they've ever watched.
Right. It's interesting because like I'm 43. So like my introduction to anime was like the original like Macross and Mazinger Z and Akira, obviously.
Yeah.
And then so that was kind of like the old school, like, you know, the 70s, 80s stuff. Appleseed, you know, things like that. And then I kind of like blanked out until, you know, until Miyazaki started like coming into Western consciousness around the late 90s. And through my career now, I know a lot of voice actors. And so therefore I know the anime properties through them. So like someone like Todd Hypercorn, who is a buddy of mine, who, you know, did everything from Fairy Tale to, you know, tons of stuff. I know a lot of the anime properties through sort of like the social circle now. So it's interesting.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw a lot of stuff on your resume, if you will, that I know would really resonate with some of our listeners, like Critical Role.
Right.
My question for you was going to be, are you a lifelong geek? And did that sort of angle your career? And I guess, yeah, you are.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's funny because like video games, comics, tabletop role-playing games, these are things that came into my life at a very early age and just were always there. I was kind of taught, like I think a lot of kids, especially my generation were, which is, okay, that's fun, but you know, you have to set that aside to do, you know, adult work or grown-up work or to have a career. Like if you want to have a family, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, I was kind of going down the road of a business major, and I think I made it like a semester into my sophomore year, but I'm like, nope, this is not how this is going to go down. And I changed my major to film. And then 9-10 years ago, I started working more in development. I got to like pitch on and develop properties that were a bit more attuned with my interests. And then once I realized that that could just be like my specialty in my career, I just never looked back. I always found a way to kind of like make that stuff front and center.
That's great. I've seen some more of your production, like back of house stuff. I noticed you spent a lot of your editing career in reality TV, actually. I mean,
yep.
Stuff
yep.
like Flavor of Love. American yep. Ninja Warrior. I have a friend who was just on American Ninja Warrior like last week. I'm so excited to see his episode.
Awesome.
But how do fans of reality TV versus fans of your other content differ? Like, what is your experience working with your viewers?
That is a super great question. I was chatting with Lee Alexander. I was talking to her on Twitter about this, and I don't discern between high and low art. She made a really good point that I'm not quite smart enough to paraphrase here, but she really sees a lot of like what she does in immersive narrative design in unscripted television. And I think she draws a lot of inspiration from that. That first season of Flavor of Love, I think I stand by as a piece of brilliant, biting satire. The seasons after that, it goes a little bit, you know, it's like, okay, it became successful. So clearly, but like when we were making that first season, we were directly parodying a lot of stuff that was on a lot of the dating reality shows. That's why I was hired, because I had worked on The Bachelor and a bunch of those other like dating house reality shows. And so our things were designed to be fun, but also to be a bit of a mirror on sort of that stuff. So I think, look, at the end of the day, when people fan out and ship characters and like the same, like when I see anime shipping specifically, like it's an asynchronous interactivity, right? Like it's not like when you're watching something on Twitch, you can type in chat, right? Or like, it's not like I get to do something here and see it manifest on screen, but it's an asynchronous interactivity, which is like, here's a thing that's happening now that I have a parasocial relationship to. Now me and my community around this are going to speculate, we're going to ship, we're going to theorize. That is a very human thing. And I think humans will find ways to do that. Book clubs. Like it's all just book club behavior. It's the same reflex, yeah? Like it's just sort of this thing that people like to do with whatever it is they consume.
I mean,
sports. The whole notion of fantasy sports is that. You know what I mean? Like it's that.
Half of what Anime Chicago does is exactly what you just entailed.
Well, I was going to say, by nature, this podcast is almost a book club of sorts. Mm-hmm. We treat every episode like its own story that we have to sort of analyze in a way that a book club might. So all that said, I think we can actually dive into today's episode, which is called Waltz for Venus.
Lauren, I'm going to be honest with you. I forgot that Waltz for Venus happened so early in the Bebop lore. I thought this was a mid-series episode, and we're only at the tail end of the first third. I wasn't expecting this heavy story so quickly.
Yes. Another point about it being so early is I am starting to realize just how much bebop there is before we ever meet Radical Edward. And I'm starting to develop my own theory about the Netflix show, which is that Ed is not going to be in season one at all because we have so many stories to tell. And then she might pop up as like the sting or the teaser for season two. You heard it here first. I'm putting my money down. There are so many stories that are great and heavy before we ever meet her. It's a risky bet, but I think I'm betting.
I think that sounds logic there. I would go with that.
So Waltz for Venus is a very cool episode because, in my opinion, we get to see the Bebop crew absolutely at the top of their bounty hunting game. They are working together as a team. They each have found their strengths. And as long as each member stays in their lane, they can catch bounties and they can succeed. Our episode starts on an airplane. There are some terrorists that hold everyone at gunpoint just over Venus, but Spike, Faye, and Jet stop them. They get the bounty. We have a fun scene of Spike and Faye sort of splitting up the money. And then we meet another man who had been on the plane, but wasn't actually one of the bounties. He is caught up at like the terminal trying to ship something. He's got this box. He throws money down. He runs and he tries to pickpocket Spike. But Spike stops him. And this man who we find out is named Rocco kind of fanboys over Spike. He's like, "You were the guy on the plane. You had these awesome martial arts moves." And even though we learn that Rocco has an extremely dire situation going on, he takes the time to sort of ask Spike to be his teacher and to teach him Jeet Kune Do.
He specifically asks Spike if he has mercy and compassion, and Spike replies, "Fresh out of that stuff." On rewatch, I realized that this episode's more than just a story about Rocco and Stella and like trying to show more of the Bebop universe. It actually resonates a bit more like the first episode does, Asteroid Blues. There's so many parallels to Spike's life and his backstory we learn later on in this episode. It was very apparent this watch through.
I also discovered this episode sort of through talking with my partner that it is very much a Western, even though the aesthetic is more like Ottoman. We have the planet Venus, which has this sort of Ottoman architecture that you might see in like Turkey. But the story itself is still very much like these lawbringers roll into town and catch the bad guys. They get wrapped up in a local story. There's a damsel in distress, a bad guy with a heart of gold. And then once everything is sort of normalized, our gunslinging heroes leave town. And I never recognized it before as sort of a genre tribute, but it totally is.
It would be an oversight if we didn't mention this directly from the Cowboy Bebop fandom wiki, but quote, "This episode is highly inspired by the 1951 noir film On Dangerous Ground. Both Stella and Rocco are inspired by the main characters. Rocco's death is similar to the main character's, spoiler, and both female characters receive a bittersweet ending. And like the main character, Rocco is only doing crime to take care of his sister." Now, whether or not that movie was inspired by Westerns, sure, maybe. I haven't seen it. But yeah, this would fall directly in line with the director's intent to replicate films through every episode.
So Spike is kind enough, or maybe bored enough, I don't know, to take Rocco out just like on the lawn in front of the airport and teach him some moves. And this is where our friend Eddie comes in. So Eddie, I was introduced to you because I sort of did a cold call to my network saying, "Does anyone know someone who studies Jeet Kune Do?" So how long have you been into martial arts and what brought you to Jeet Kune Do specifically?
Great question. I started, all of my hobbies and interests fold in on one another and inspire the other, kind of like an M.C. Escher painting. So I got I got into martial arts because I was really into tabletop role-playing games. And there was there's a game company called Palladium. And if you know the TTRPG world, Palladium summons all sorts of memories and thoughts and opinions. But I was playing their Robotech game, and they had another game called Ninjas and Super Spies. It's bad. I just want to say this. It's a really bad game. It's like it's horrifically bad. But I bought the book, and the cool thing about the book was when you play like a martial arts character in that book, and it literally is just ninjas and super spies. That's it. That's the whole premise of the world. When you buy that game, every like martial arts character gets like to study two different styles. And this dude encyclopedically lists probably like four dozen styles like of martial arts. I used to just read that thing. I used to just like, whoa, this is amazing. And I would process different martial arts based on the game mechanics that they assessed and like assigned to each style. That I felt like allowed me to like demystify the martial arts in a very real way. The problem is that none of that shit was accurate. Like it was a lot of speculation, man. But it was a toehold, right? It was a foot point. And I remember really liking the kit assigned to Tai Chi. Like Tai Chi Chuan had like a really interesting kit. I'm like, ooh, that sounds good. And I was really into like studying philosophy. So like I had read the Tao Te Ching, and like I had known that a lot of the Chinese internal styles were more informed by Buddhism and Taoism, and had more of like a philosophical spiritual slant to them. So I found a Tai Chi school, started training there. From there, I started cross training in Kung Fu. And if you do any kind of Kung Fu for any amount of time, you inevitably hear about Jeet Kune Do. So I found a JKD instructor and started training. And that led to other martial arts that I practice to this day. Jeet Kune Do is kind of like, to level set, Jeet Kune Do isn't really a style so much as a philosophy. It's this idea that Bruce Lee was a big fan of this quote that Michelangelo had, which was, you know, someone once asked Michelangelo how he sculpted David. And he just said, yeah, it's easy. I remove everything that isn't David. And which is kind of like a smarmy, oh, you're so clever kind of nonsense. But there's an understanding to that. So Bruce was about, we don't add, we reduce. So only do the things that work for you. My Jeet Kune Do is going to look different than yours. Yeah, so that's kind of how I came to it. I trained it. Training in Jeet Kune Do gave me a window in a couple other martial arts like Muay Thai and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and that's what I practiced today.
So that sounds like Spike's Jeet Kune Do falls very much in line with what you would expect any practitioner to be doing, right? Did you see any inaccuracies or anything that stood out to you in particular?
So I will say that what Bruce Lee did in the films wasn't necessarily Jeet Kune Do. Bruce did what looked good in films. But there are things you see in Bruce's movies that are absolutely JKD. If you watch, like, let's say, Enter the Dragon, that first fight in Enter the Dragon, there's a little bit of everything. There's some long-range kicking. There's some trapping, some of the stuff from that Bruce brought in from Wing Chun. That's a little bit of JKD amidst all of these sort of, like, cinematic flourishes. I would say that what Spike does in the anime is much more aligned with that. There are some subtle touches. The way that, and it wasn't in this episode, but in my research for this, I saw a couple times where he would throw a high kick, the way his kicking knee would bend a certain way. I could tell it's like, okay, that's a trace from a couple like still images of Bruce. It's all copying Bruce. A lot of it is very much like starting from a still image of Bruce and working backwards into the fluid motion of the scene. So there's like hints of it. I wouldn't say it's like a one-to-one of what people understand as JKD, but there's accents to it. He kicks a lot. There's not as much kicking.
He's a big kicker. he likes his legs.
there's not, generally speaking, there's not that much kicking, especially head kicking in real Jeet Kune Do. It's much more influenced by like fencing and savate, which is a French kickboxing style that goes back a couple hundred years. And it's sort of like torso mid-level leg kicks, as opposed to like these big sort of like flashy wheel kicks and stuff like that.
Spike, this episode leans really heavily into be like water and reacting without thought and taking the opponent's excessive force and using it against them. Is that a universal thing in JKD, or is that more just Spike's personal sauce?
That is 1,000% Jake Abey. That is the documentary about Bruce Lee that ESPN produced a few years ago, or last year, I should say, is called Be Water. Because there's that famous Bruce Lee quote, be like water. Water is soft. It can flow or it can crash. You fill a cup, it becomes the cup. You fill a bucket, it becomes the bucket. It's still or it can flow. You know, like it be like water, my friend. Like that's the definitive Bruce Lee perspective. It's a standard sort of like Buddhism perspective, but a lot of like what Spike says and does is, I wouldn't say a quote of Bruce per se, but it's some significant paraphrasing, which is great. I mean, as a Bruce Lee nerd, I'm here for it.
So you would recommend the documentary so people get a better understanding? Absolutely.
It does what a lot of other stories about. It's pretty comprehensive. I would say that's like the best single source of history on Bruce because it helps really frame and contextualize the inherent racial bias, not just in Hollywood he encountered, but in Hong Kong. The cultural impact that he had in Hong Kong, I think, can't be understated. Also, just, you know, how he came to America, his struggles and stuff like that. I think that's, and you can see how that like shapes his philosophy and his stuff. Yeah, definitely.
My partner made me binge the Ip Man films, all four of them, of which I believe were an absolute delight for any action film lover.
Much love to Donnie Yen. I love those movies. Not in any way accurate to anything, but that's so.
But they're really like, yeah, we made Bruce Lee who he is.
You know, I mean, no doubt Ip Man was Bruce's teacher in Wing Chun, and he was huge influence in his life, and Bruce had a great relationship with him until his death. But it's.
So Spike dumps a bunch of this Bruce Lee sort of know-how onto Rocco. Rocco's hoping to have this kind of teacher relationship with this man he just met. But then we find Rocco's former colleagues are after him. Rocco takes this bundle that he has in his hands, he shoves it into Spike's arms and runs. We find out that inside this bundle is a very rare and expensive plant called gray ash. Faye wants to sell it. Jet refuses because Jet has sort of a moral code that he doesn't want to break, or maybe he just doesn't want to get into somebody else's bad business. Spike decides he's going to kind of keep his word and go to this meeting after all. He goes out looking for Rocco, and he's held at gunpoint by his sister. This is where we meet Stella and learn how Stella has been affected by the planet Venus.
This was a fascinating plot point. In particular, we don't see Venus again. This is the first time we actually see traces of what the terraforming process was like for a specific atmosphere, and that it actually does impact human health in some substantial way. Another interesting point is Venus has a lot of helium, but somehow people can still breathe enough oxygen to carry on their basic human functions. We're also introduced to a lot of Middle Eastern-based architecture. This particularly suggests that there's a large Arab and Turkish population. Another big sci-fi thing we're introduced to, the ideas of commercial spacecraft and space travel. Airports still suck. But there are things like fixed interval shuttles, as according to the anime guide, that transport folks and their whiny kids to Venus. So the scene where the bounty opens up the bag and there's just a machine gun, both my partner and I yelled out, "How?" at the same time.
Yeah, it's easy to see why there was a string, I think, of episodes that did not initially air right after 9/11 back in the day. In terms of being insensitive towards that act of terrorism in its time, just a bad series, serendipitously bad series of, we had an episode with a person falling out a window, now we have an episode where a plane is hijacked, and it's just not what people wanted to see.
It's also not getting any better. Spoilers.
No, you're right.
There are other things that come later, so
I'm just going to die on this hill and say that Venus sucks. And Venus is a real testament to how, even with all of this amazing sci-fi technology, the human race really hasn't changed. Like, they haven't made the atmosphere super breathable. There are announcements on every airplane saying, just so you know, there are horrible spores here. And for most people, it'll be okay. But some of you are going to have terrible allergic reactions. And if you don't get medical assistance, you might go blind. The healthcare system obviously has not improved much, because Stella's whole struggle is that Venus sickness is apparently treatable, but only for people with the money and clout to gather rare ingredients and pay for a very expensive procedure. And I was just so sad watching this world where the planet is extremely populated and going on living their day-to-day lives, clearly ignoring the fact that the environment is creating disabilities for people. The episode ends with the spores coming down, and we've just all sort of accepted this really ruins some people's lives, and we've decided we're willing to let that be.
Hey, that feels a little too real here. this is a sci-fi anime podcast.
I didn't come here to be depressed. Listen,
I know.
Well, then they could have chosen to write a nicer future, and they didn't.
Fair enough.
That's true. They didn't. One positive thing that happened this episode, the crew finally caught bounties. They have captured Huey, Dewey, and Louie, making this their first three bounties we've seen on camera out of the last 10 that they've been trying to capture.
Yes, Huey, Dewey, and Louie were worth 1.5 million Wulong. The text under their bounties when I paused was actually gibberish. So the episode cares so little about them that it didn't even give us a story for them. They're just fodder. Jet finally buys good dog food for Ayn because the crew of the Bebop is sitting pretty on some cash. We're also introduced to a whole slew of new bounties, including Picaro Calvino, who's worth 500K, and his gang. Every one of the guys in that group is worth around 100K. One of those men is Roko. And apparently, if all of them are caught, the bounty doubles. So there is some incentive for the Bebop crew to work really hard. And I guess there are 8 of them total. I was going to say we caught all of them, but no, I don't think we caught 8.
We did not, no. Circling back to the themes of this episode, we get the impression that Spike has a soft spot for people who are in bad situations, but inherently seem like good individuals. In particular, we hear a lot about being water, which kind of references his nightmare in Sympathy for the Devil. We also have the music box theme playing in this episode that foreshadows future episodes coming up soon. And then there's also a couple of cats kind of littered around the episode. I caught 2, and we find out later there are parallels to cats and symbolism in cats. So this whole episode's littered with foreshadowing, and I'd never caught that in previous watch-throughs.
It makes a whole lot of sense that you would say Spike has a soft spot for sort of the criminal with the heart of gold, because Stella even says that that is him in this episode. She senses good in Spike. She says there's something beautiful. And Spike kind of looks out the window and says he lost anything like that a long time ago. So Spike may be seeing himself in people like Roko.
She calls him beautiful in the dub, right?
Yes.
And we're supposed to have the impression that he's this like jaded, hardened criminal, but he's nothing like the other bounty hunters we've seen in the series. And then he's also going this extra mile for both Roko and Stella when he could just peace out at any time. Faye's not doing that though. Faye is definitely in it for the hard cash.
Yeah, Faye is hilarious in this episode, in that the second she gets her money, she goes off to the casino. She says it's more fun than the bank. And I really liked the fact that Spike sticks up for her. Jet's like, oh, she's running off and gambling. And Spike in the dub and the sub is kind of like, it's not our money, it's hers. Who cares? I think they're really starting to respect each other.
So in regards to teaching martial arts, is it possible for someone who's new at it to, I don't know, flip a person over with 24 hours of training?
So yes, it's possible. It's not very high percentage, but yeah, it's theoretically it's not impossible. If you've drilled one move and that's in your mind, then you see the opportunity for that, sure. In jiu-jitsu, we'll get taught a technique. And, you know, when you spar in that class, you're looking for an opportunity to do that technique a lot. And maybe one in every 10 times, you actually do get to pull it off in training the day you learn it. So, yeah, that's low percentage, but possible.
I'm happy for Rocco then, but then also he dies. So
you can only be so happy for him, Jamie.
Right.
Well, you pointed out what Faye was up to this episode, and I want to give hats off to her because she is extremely competent this time around. She goes after Picaro. She shoots up a bar, not only using her feminine wiles, as they say, but shooting the guns out of five guys' hands, like in quick succession. Just an amazing, fantastical shot. And fun fact, we also brought Eddie here to talk to us a little bit about firearms and ammunition.
Oh,
he's just a real topic unicorn out here.
Topic unicorn. That's going to be my official title. That's going on LinkedIn.
Topic unicorn. Put it on a business card. I just been very taken by the presence of and the accuracy of guns in Cowboy Bebop. It's not my hobby. It's not my cup of tea. But as our friend Marshall said on a previous episode, a lot of fans of this show end up buying Jericho's, buying Spike's gun, and sort of showing it off as a form of fandom. So that's not what I'm up to. So we figured we'd talk to a friend instead. So just as some background, my understanding is you were an ammunition specialist in the Army. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Is that a role you sign up for, or were you chosen for it? How does that become your title?
I get to tell the story. Okay, because there is a story on this one. So long story short, I was in high school as an ROTC, just like our mutual friend Brian. Before, because I was going to go on ROTC and be an officer and stuff, but I'm like, you know what, let me serve as an enlisted man in the reserves. Let me go through boot camp. Let me go through, you know, the AIT, which is like the job training. Let me be an enlisted soldier before I become an officer. Let me do that. And when you join the military, you have your basic training, which every soldier goes through, which is usually 8.5 weeks, depending on how long your reception battalion is. And then you have your AIT, advanced individual training, and that varies in length on whatever your job is. So if you're a, you know, laundry technician, you probably got like a 5 to 6 week, you know, advanced individual training. If you do something a bit more complicated, like, you know, Signal Corps, satellite, something like that, then you're looking at like 15, 20 weeks. You know, combat engineers is 15 weeks all in. So I was like, okay, cool. I ideally would like a, you know, 4 to 9 month advanced individual training. I really didn't care what job I had. I just was more about just doing the service. So I go to, it's called MEPS, it's Military Entrance Processing Station. I've been out of the military for 20 years, so I'm trying to remember all this stuff now. So I go there and you take this test called the ASVAB, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. All this stuff just keeps coming back. And then they tell you what your top 25 jobs are. And the first three jobs that I was best suited for were all in PSYOPs, which nowadays has kind of come into like public consciousness because of like conspiracy theory stuff. But yeah, it was PSYOPs, it was psychological warfare. I'm like, what does that mean? And they're like, oh, it's propaganda, misinformation, false broadcasts, you know, destroy enemy morale from media and stuff like that. I'm like, sounds amazing. Okay, yeah. How long is the training? Like, well, you've got 20 weeks of OSIT, which is boot camp and AIT together. Then you've got airborne school, which is 3 weeks. Then you've got language school. Then you've got the course. So you're looking at like 30 some odd weeks. I'm like, I can't. That's like it was almost like it was a ridiculous amount of time. Like it was a ridiculous commitment that I couldn't do. So we go down the list, and then about 10 options in, like ammo specialist. I'm like, what does that do? Like, you count bullets and then you blow them up. I'm like, okay, like how long is it? They're like,
They're like 12 week AIT. I'm like, done. Home in 20 weeks, done. Yeah. So that was how I became that job. You have to identify every small arm up to just shy of nuclear, like every chemical weapons. You have to be able to identify and know how they function, how they perform, what they do to the human body, what, you know, type of weapon they're fired out of. You get to learn things like, okay, like let's say the AK-47, which is Soviet made, but utilized by everybody who's not American, they can capture your ammunition and fire it with a subcaliber device. But if you capture theirs, the bullets are too big for the M16. So you can't do anything with theirs. So you've got to destroy it. So things like that, you learn little, I cannot tell you how irrelevant to my day-to-day life this stuff is now.
I just am so fascinated by how granular that knowledge sounds, but obviously some of that granular knowledge that you don't get to use in your everyday life ended up in an anime. There is a website that is basically a wiki, and we can link it for our listeners. It's a firearm wiki that tells you what every character uses in the show. So we know Spike uses a customized Jericho 941R. I don't know what that is. I don't know if I said it wrong. But they even talk about like what specific pieces he customized, because the art is drawn specifically to show changes that he had to have made to the weapon once it was sort of out of the box. We know that Jet uses a Walther P99, which is a police weapon. So this is just sort of hypothesizing maybe, but why do you think a show like this or any anime would get this specific and this realistic about guns?
It's a great question. It's certainly a creative choice. What I do know about Cowboy Bebop is that there's no shortage of like conflict, especially in an episode like this one where it had, I think you said earlier, kind of like a Wild West vibe to it. I also think it's just another layer of immersion that maybe other animes don't do, frankly. And honestly, if I'm, you know, like, I'm not a bit, to set the record, I'm not a gun nut. I don't own guns. Once a year, I will go down to the range to rent a firearm and target shoot, just because, like, as a skill practice, it is good to, like, I find enjoyment in just target shooting. I don't own a weapon and firearm. I don't want to get political on this, but I'm not a big gun advocate in any real way. That said, I've got this immense wealth of knowledge that I'm just sitting on. So, you know, for me, and I think it's kind of fascinating, right? And like, one thing I do know to be true about firearms is that if you have fired them, they leave a big sensory impression from the force of the weapon, the smell of the gunpowder, the sound. There's nothing quite like that sound that you get mimicked in everyday life. There's not been one movie or TV show I have ever seen that like fully nails the sound of a firearm, because even if you record it, play it back, you're not getting the air compression around you. Like it's a very real thing. So I think maybe as like an immersion, and also another way to show personality, right? Like just looking it up, the Jericho 941, it's an Israeli weapon. It's used by police and military out there. It's a 9mm, you know, handgun. And 9mm, like, it's almost like some people, you can tell a lot by their personality, by what their favorite burger chain is, right? Like, there are some people, I'm from California, so In-N-Out, Fatburger are like, the In-N-Out, Fatburger debate is no joke. Like, here in LA, it's like, you can tell a lot about a person by what neighborhood they're from, if they prefer In-N-Out to Fatburger or vice versa. So for me, it's like, I have a preferred 9mm that I like to fire. And I think that says, maybe that's an insight into me in some way, if you happen to know everything about it. That's my assumption of why you get that detailed into character's choices about anything. But that's, you know, that'd be my guess.
So I don't want to be the wet blanket here, but I cracked open the anime guide, not expecting anything useful for this episode. And there is specifically a headline that says guns. Quote, the guns were chosen by the director in discussion with Mr. Imakake and Mr. Yamane. They talked about how they didn't want common guns because that wouldn't be very interesting. So they decided on these guns.
That's fair. Yeah. And to be fair, like a Jericho 941 is not a common gun. Like a common gun would be Glock, Smith and Wesson, you know, those would be sort of like somewhat common, you know, handguns, the Walther P90, like that.
So you said the Walther and the Glock are more common guns because those are actually the two other guns that our characters use.
The Glock is extraordinarily common. The Walther is slightly less common.
Okay.
You know, like that'd be your Sonic burger, right? Like that'd be like the, it's like, oh yeah, it's common, but you gotta drive a little while to get there. It's like the White Castle. It's like, you gotta get, for me, for y'all, if based in Chicago, you probably have White Castles much closer than I do.
Have one like a couple blocks away.
fair. So yeah, the Glock is like the Walmart of guns. It's plastic. It's lightweight. It's very easy to, it's very boxy. It's very ugly, but it's very well balanced. It's just easy. If you're learning, a Glock is probably the easiest one.
So I'm going to kind of combine two questions here. What makes a firearm the right one for a specific purpose? So like, this one's great as a police weapon versus I'm a first timer and I want something to take to the range and get comfortable with the idea of owning a gun. Like, how do you recommend something for a purpose?
The purpose is driven by the ammunition itself. So what is the round designed to do? And then it becomes, what is the best delivery method for that piece of ammunition? So I'll use as an example the M16, because that's the one I have like the most, which by the way, the M16 and the R15, exact same gun, exact same parts, exact same everything. The only difference is that the R15 doesn't have a bayonet mount and an adjustable front sight. Everything else is the same. Putting that aside, the M16 is a weapon designed for a specific reason, because the round itself is designed for a specific reason. It's a 22 caliber round, which means it's small. It is a hollow point. It's collapsible. So it essentially creates a mushrooming effect. So that means, compared to the AK-47, which is a full metal jacket round, the 7.76 millimeter ball round goes through and through. So if it hits the right stuff, it'll drop somebody. The 5.56 millimeter round, which is what the M16 fires, that is designed to expand and collapse and fold in on itself and create a larger surface area and kind of bounces in the body and stays there. It doesn't really exit. There's not a ton of exit wounds on the M16 round. And that's for a reason. The reason for that is because if I, as one soldier, kill another soldier, that one bullet has caused, you know, the removal of one enemy combatant. But if that round doesn't fully kill them, but wounds them grievously, then 1, 2, 3 additional enemy combatants now have to stop what they're doing and get them off of the battlefield. That's called a force multiplier. It's this concept in warfare of, okay, one bullet kills one person, right? But the force multiplier of the way it's designed to grievously wound and not immediately kill allows that to happen. I would choose handguns over rifles for shorter range, shorter range, more close-up personal sort of action as opposed to distance firing. I would choose that for to be just very effective. You know, a 22 pistol is probably not going to stop a person, right? A 45 will stop a person, but will also damage the, you know, structure behind them. If you're looking to target one silhouette and only damage that silhouette, your 9mm is probably your best way to go. So in that regards, there's no such thing as a safe firearm, but there's that is your safest option to avoid, you know,
killing your bounty head, for example, and not getting the reward.
Exactly. So I think like the handguns is just honestly just person to person. You know, I'm not trying to lay down suppressive fire. If I'm firing a handgun, it's because I'm trying to eliminate one target only.
To the point about taking out more people, there is a point in this episode where I did kind of raise my eyebrows and go, whoa, oh my gosh, oh no. And that is when the ships get brought into the gunfight. Like, Faye and Jet both show up in their respective spacecraft. And suddenly, we're not just shooting at one person anymore. We're doing property damage. We're filling the air with bullets. And I really felt that difference.
I will add, just as an anecdote, how many old cathedrals are there in this solar system? Like, they're just, let's just go shoot up the old cathedral. That'll be safe.
The episode really reaches its peak in this scene because, to your earlier point, Jamie, Rocco does have this moment where he's remembering Spike's teachings. He flips somebody. He does it. He gives his master kind of a thumbs up, and then he's dead. It's very sad. But he has a few moments, Rocco, where he's still alive, and Spike promises to help Stella get the treatment she needs. So the music box had some seeds in it, and even though we lose the gray ash plant that we were carrying around with us the whole episode, we do have the bounty money and the seedlings to help her out. Spike has no, like, tangible reason to keep his word. Rocco is no longer of this world. He's not going to be able to check. But Spike keeps his promise, and the episode ends in Stella's hospital room. We learn Stella has never seen Rocco with her own eyes. She for sure won't, even when she does have her sight back. And Spike tells her he was a terrific guy, and kind of whatever she has in her mind, however she thinks he is, she may as well go on believing that that's who he really was. And I think that's really sweet. It's kind of a mercy because Stella is aware that Rocco is in with the bad crowd, but I'm not sure she ever quite knows how bad it got.
There's a theme this episode. Are people inherently good or bad? And you get the idea that Stella can see, quote, something beautiful inside them, and that makes you wonder, oh, does Julia see this? Is Spike this inherently good person? He's deserving of trust right away, which explains all of the other bounties he's encountered and been nice towards. How can someone like Spike, who we presume is an assassin for a syndicate, still be good and earn this kind of trust and make good with all of the bad seeds, so to speak? So when Rocco asks, if I had met you earlier, do you think we would have been friends? Like, that makes it so sad. He sees himself in Spike. He's like, he wants to make that connection. You know, it seems like two good people are just on the wrong side of things. And there's some kind of commiseration going on there. So yeah, I think Spike, he ends up having these feelings for Rocco. It is pure little goon who's running with the wrong crowd. It's so adorable, and then it's so heartbreaking.
Yeah, what really tugs on my heart about that scene is that I don't think Spike necessarily sees himself as someone to be idolized or someone that anyone would want to be friends with. He kind of lets it happen in this episode. He develops a bond like that, but Spike kind of has a death wish. We've established in previous episodes that, yeah, we have this bounty hunting thing going on, but Spike's ultimate arc is Julia and Vicious. And I don't think he's out here trying to make new friends or start new stories before his own death. And so the idea that somebody would meet him and want to be his friend, he's probably not thought about it before.
Yeah, I hadn't considered it that way. That makes it sadder.
Eddie didn't come here to get depressed. We're ruining it.
I'm sorry. This is the Spike Spiegel sad show, and every episode's end up, they all end up like this.
Well, let's talk about, to brighten up the room a little bit, what is funny in this episode? Because we've covered, I think, the dark stuff, and I just have some quick fire moments that are worth talking about. We see like a parody of Tom and Jerry as the in-flight movie at the very beginning, which is super funny. Spike's mask that has eyeballs on it, I just love, because at some point in his life, he made that choice. He decided, like, this is the one for me, and he bought it and he brought it with him on the plane. We see Spike once again smoking next to a no smoking sign. And the elevator that he's in at the airport says, "We support your nice trip every day." And it was just so pleasant. It was pleasant to read that.
On first watch through, way back when, I wasn't expecting our bad guy to be the Notorious B.I.G. And apparently this is no joke or speculation. They actually wanted the Notorious B.I.G. in this story, so they drew him.
I found his, like, futuristic glasses and jacket to be more CeeLo Green, but I believe that. I believe that it could be Biggie. There's also in the market scene, like a guy smoking hookah in the background. And I just caught how put out he looks, that like he's has to be a part of this scene when he's just trying to mind his own business. So if you can catch that guy, it's just really funny. And in the bathroom, a gang member sincerely tells his friend to remember to wash his hands, which means a lot to me.
It's different.
Yeah, well, we're hunting down our friend, but this is an important and hygienic thing for you to do, my good buddy.
Lauren, you mentioned earlier that this episode was postponed on its original airing from Adult Swim, but they also did a number of edits to episodes throughout the show, just to make it a little bit more, you know, TV appropriate. However, this episode, when Faye runs in on the two men in the bedroom, they definitely turned the man on the bottom into a pillow. I'm not even kidding. Wow.
I had wondered if that information was going to be accessible to me, because she definitely walks in on a sex scene. And I was like, there's no way, when I was watching this as a teen, that that's what was on the screen. What was it, though? A pillow.
Let's just dehumanize this entire relationship and turn him into a pillow. And just like, I don't know if that still airs right now, right? Because they still show Cowboy Bebop on reruns on Adult Swim. If they haven't addressed that issue, they probably should. Just woof.
Yeah, and I don't feel like we are treating the couple as a joke. I mean, it's a funny scene in the sense that, like, Faye comes barging in, but they're not the punchline necessarily. Like, they're just having a moment together. So I wouldn't mind seeing it on TV, but I bet parents would go crazy.
Oh, of course.
Speaking of seeing it on TV, I would really love, not necessarily this storyline, I could give or take the Waltz for Venus storyline, but I would love to see Venus itself on the Netflix live action. Every time we do this show, we try to speculate about the live action, and just the foliage, like weeping over the edge of the derelict ships in the desert, the sort of islands in the sky. I think this is a beautiful set that it would be great to see done with the technology of today. Even though it holds up, I mean, it looks great in animation too. Again, show me more.
That brings me to my cool factor. Thanks for the lead-in. Stella lives in an abandoned shuttle. We presume this shuttle came directly from Earth when Earth's inhabitants fled and landed on Venus. So I don't know whether to be like in awe that space travel happened and it's cool that we get to see this little glimmer of previous generations, or like terrified that she has to live in a shuttle. This poor woman.
My cool factor was just a very brief moment at the very beginning of the episode when we rescue the plane from the hijackers, and the name Bebop painted on the side of the ship sort of descends in the window of the aircraft. Just very cool.
It felt very official, which is strange for the crew.
Yeah, like we said at the beginning, they're just in top form. Eddie, how do you feel about this anime, this classic, being rebooted for live action audiences, or maybe just anime being put on Netflix in general?
Anime in general on Netflix, I think, is great, because I think it exposes folks to new audience, or to folks who maybe didn't see it. I know, like, there's lots of reasons when and why anime and mangas break through sort of in public consciousness, like Death Note, you know, a few years back, sort of broke through. If the algorithms can like lead newer viewers on the rabbit hole, great. As far as like the remakes, you know, like Avatar, when that which I know is not anime per se, but like the idea of like this beloved animated property getting a live action reboot, it's hard to do because so much of what makes anime exciting is you can do things you can't do in live action. It's this, you know, people don't fight like they do in anime, either a sword fight or hand to hand, or you know, it's the scale, it's the scope, it's the volume turned up on every moment, or fantastic vistas and soundscapes that are just so amazing to watch. And it's like, it just feels like you have to work so hard in live action to just capture a fraction of that, that it's like, why? Unless you have character-based properties that you want to go more into human facial expression. So something like Your Name. Yeah, I know this is probably blasphemy. That makes, at least I can track the logic of remaking that in live action. I can sort of like, I can understand what you're trying to go for there. But with something like Cowboy, where it's like, it's a spacefaring shoot 'em up melodrama. Like, and like, I want that to be in. So wish him luck. I like John Cho, who's going to be playing Spike in this. You know, I like John Cho a lot. I'll watch anything he does. And if it leads to more people discovering the anime, great. Like when a pop singer remakes a classic song and that causes a spike in downloads of the original, then great. Then more power to it.
I would say if it were 10 years ago, I would have more hesitance. But since I've watched 3 seasons of Westworld, my opinion's changed. And so I think there's hope. I think that there's going to be this great production. But also, you know, keep your expectations low so you're not disappointed. I'd keep oscillating between the two, as Lauren knows.
Yeah, and spoiler alert, I mean, at least for my part, I started this podcast knowing the Netflix show was coming in hopes that we would already be in production and on the ground to talk about the Netflix show when it airs. We intend to do that. But we have to start with the anime, because even if the Netflix show is a disappointment, we will always have the anime to watch. I have watched through it so many times. I will watch through it so many more. And every time I watch it, I find something new. And we hope that our show helps you think about it in new ways and find new Easter eggs and exciting, you know, components. Like this time we went, wow, there's a lot more foreshadowing than we thought. And we've watched this so many times. So you'll definitely be able to listen to us and enjoy the animation as many times as you want, even if you don't like the new stuff. We have really enjoyed hanging out with you, Eddie. Thanks for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Please tell us what's next up for you and where our listeners can engage with you.
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Kirby.Matrix. So Twitter, Kirby.Matrix. I don't really stream on Twitch that often, but when I do, you can find me at ZeroDork30 on Twitch. And then my project right now that I'm working on is a little hush-hush, but I'm doing something kind of cool for Bally's Interactive. So Bally's, the makers of the old pinball cabinets.
Yeah.
So they recently rebranded the Fox Sports Networks as the Bally Sports Networks. So I'm working with Bally Interactive to develop something kind of cool to interface with some of their sports properties. So I'm working on that now. And then I think, you know, sometime in July, you should be able to see that.
That's exciting.
We love a pinball machine here in Chicago. We have many barcades with many pinball machine.
Yes, indeed. But yeah, this is a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Next week, she's finally here. It's Jammin' with Edward and the Bebop crew will be complete. So we'll see you all next week. Bye. Thank you for listening to the Bebop Beat. If you like our show, please rate us on Apple or wherever you find your podcasts. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bebop Beat. Our email address is bebopbeatpodcast@gmail.com.
The Bebop Beat is hosted and produced by Jamie Sanchez and Lauren Fates. Our editor and associate producer is Angela Geis. Our logo and art assets are by Kat Janda.
Special thanks this episode goes out to Brian Finifter.
And his goddaughter was in The Mandalorian this last season.
Oh.
So I know this isn't a Mandalorian podcast, but who Ahsoka Tano fights for the Beskar Spear, Dan Inosanto, who is Bruce Lee's like best friend and partner in Jeet Kune Do, that's his daughter, and Bruce was her godfather.
That's awesome.
Yeah.